Hey, y'all, how's it going? Oh, that's good. I mean, I guess. I don't know, I can't really hear you. I know, that was funny the first time. Yeah, it's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Today on the show, Rob Bryan is going to be here. He wrote a thing for Mondo Weiss that I want to talk with you about. And, you know, there's somebody else from Mondo Weiss I'm trying to get a hold of, but I don't know her email address. Let me see here. Yep, that's right. I'm arranging my radio show in the middle of my radio show. Was just tweeting somebody trying to get her on the show. Another Mondo Weiss writer. Allison Degger, assistant editor there. I want to talk with her about this article. Clashes break out across West Bank after Netanyahu declares, quote, an all-out war. Oh, crap. It may or may not be the beginning of the third intifada. I don't know. But I sent out an invite to Ramzi Baroud, but, you know, Ramzi can usually never do it on short notice. So, I think probably we won't hear back from him. And then, you know, I think every other Palestinian I know, I just never hear back from when I invite them. So, kind of quit trying, but I need to do better about that. Find some new Palestinian guests to cover this stuff. But anyway, a lot going on in Jerusalem right now. Let's see if I can get that covered for you. I mentioned this article the other day. Rob Bryan wrote this thing, The Refreshing Bluntness of Eilat Shaked. And this is basically the Attorney General of Israel. And she is an avowed genocidal psychopathic lunatic who has declared that all the women and children of Palestine's lives are forfeit. The babies, why, they're just little snakes to be exterminated. According to the top law enforcement official, the Justice Minister of Israel. And Rob Bryan, he went and saw her give a talk in New York City the other day and learned some things about her. Has a story to tell. I think you might like it. So that's coming up. And then, you know, I had a libertarian I was going to interview about the TPP, but then it turned out that, he's actually not really an expert in the TPP, but just in, you know, the principle of free trade, which means, of course, he's opposed to the TPP root and branch because it's not free trade. Knows that much. But I really want a libertarian who's good on principle and actually knows what the hell they're talking about when it comes to the details of the thing. Or at least, you know, as much has been made public so far, that kind of deal. Someone who's really up on it so they can really explain it from a libertarian point of view, but also just a factual one, you know. So, chat room guys, if you have any suggestions, let me know. Let's see if I can find out about that. All right. Yeah, I got a bunch of stuff to cover on the show today. There's America and Russia and Al-Qaeda and Iran and et cetera in Syria. There's a little bit of Ukraine news. I should get to this Ukraine stuff. Oh, yeah, and I want to talk about this Brzezinski thing. Well, I guess that'll go in my Russia, Syria section. I think Brzezinski might be actually losing his mind. I think maybe he's going senile now. Because he ain't just off base here. He's confusingly wacky. But I guess we'll see, you know. All right. And just a few minutes to the break, so I guess it's as good a time as any. If I gotta talk about Rand, it's best to do it in the first segment right before the break, so as to keep it short. Rand Paul, what is it with this guy? You know, yesterday on the show, most of the best stuff happened during the commercial break before I could bring the live audio up, but I brought up some of the live audio, and he was on Wolf Blitzer, and he was being good on Afghanistan and Syria both. And he actually, as I was explaining on the show yesterday, has a history of being bad on Afghanistan. You know, he got to the Senate after the debate over the surge was over and all that kind of thing, but he had previously signed on a letter telling Obama to stay in Afghanistan after 2014. And, yesterday he was on TV saying, no, we should just leave. There's no point in being there any longer, and more or less, who cares if it gets worse, because at this point, obviously, we're not making it better, and this kind of thing, I don't know. Actually, what he was really saying was, we're fighting for them, and they have to fight for themselves, and they're like, you know, on welfare, and they just refuse to do the fighting, when, you know, of course, he's excluding all the Afghans who are fighting to kick the Americans out, pretending all resistance is, you know, terrorism and the Taliban and that kind of thing, which is a bunch of crap, obviously, and has been all along. But whatever, even if he's got to give a right-wing excuse, it's good that, you know, a screw them excuse for leaving. That's good enough for me. Whatever. That's as anti-war as Rand Paul gets. All right, fine. But then, he puts out this thing. Did you see, it's at Lou Rockwell's blog this morning. The political theater blog. Where the hell did my link go? Let's see, Rand Paul Coward. It's just right here. Hang on a second. Rand Paul's having a contest. Ron Paul's presidential runs were always replete with spontaneous, high-quality, volunteer YouTube creativity. Songs, poems, ads, longer videos, Ron speeches, Ron news clips. Now Rand is asking for volunteer-made ads. Here are the rules. Nothing about the war, or no, the war. Nothing about war or the Fed, please. And it's, even before you get to that part, remember that? Even in 2012, which wasn't as exciting as the 08 campaign, but 2011, 2012, people made all kinds of their own videos about Ron, promoting Ron, frustrated with his campaign, made better videos of Ron than his campaign was making since they were running him like he was Rand. Stupid idiot political advisor types. People made their own ads. Where's the revolution, Rand? Where's the love? Where's the excitement? It's not there. Why? Because he's not even a pale imitation of his father. He's a pale imitation of Mitch McConnell. He's already completely blown his chance at that kind of loyalty, which it stuck for a long time. I mean, it took him being as horrible as he could possibly be to get the Ron Paul fans to finally just throw up their hands and get over him. But then, yeah, seriously, submission guidelines, please make a homemade Rand Paul for president video. And here are the themes that you're allowed to discuss. Term limits. Really, term limits. You know, I'm so excited. Are they going to amend the Constitution? No. So what is that? That's nothing. Defeat the Washington machine. Ending the IRS. Yeah. With his 14.5% VAT tax. NSA spine. The only thing any good in there. No mention of the wars. He's bad on war. He don't want you to put that in there. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here. Are you a libertarian and or peacenik? Live in North America? If you want, you can hire me to come and give a speech to your group. I'm good on the terror, war, and intervention, civil liberty stuff, blaming Woodrow Wilson for everything bad in the world, Iran, central banking, political realignment, and, well, you know, everything. I can teach markets to liberals and peace to the right. Just watch me. Check out scotthorton.org/speeches for some examples and email me scott@scotthorton.org for more information. See you there. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Hey, join up the chat room. Some of the boys are hanging out in there already this morning. Hey, guys. How's things? I'm belatedly creating a blog entry for the blog reading folk here. Check out my blog, Stress. You can watch last night's episode of Eye on the Empire with Jeffrey Tucker there if you want. You'd also watch it at liberty.me, where I'm posting today's show notes. And on Twitter, at Scott Horton Show, if you want to follow me on there. So, I'm sorry. I didn't time it right. The break interrupted me right at the part where I was complaining about a thing I wasn't done complaining about yet. Why'd everybody love Ron Paul so much? First of all, it's because he's honest. People said, wow, there's a politician who, first of all, you can just tell by looking at him, he's got a genuine smile on his face. He's got a sunny disposition. He's a decent, kind old man. You know, he's a nice old guy. And he always tells the truth about whatever political thing. He never says what you're supposed to say. He says what he wants to say instead. Ron Paul, what are we going to do about the rising costs of Medicare? Well, I don't know. How about we abolish the empire? And they go, oh, completely? And he goes, yeah. He told the Washington Post, we could defend this country with a couple of good submarines. Give me a break. Yeah, see? And people love that. And then he would say, you see, most people don't understand that the government's central bank, the Federal Reserve, its purpose is a bailout a day. Every day. That's what it is. It's the lender of last resort. It keeps banks that are doing bad business in business. It generates giant bubbles. It puts our economy through these horrible traumas. And the war, we don't need it. The war is the cause of our terrorism problem, not the solution to it. And the American people went, wow, well, significant numbers of them. Millions and millions and millions went, wow, man, that guy's really telling the truth about this stuff. That's an interesting thing. Ludwig von Mises, huh? I guess I'm going to read some of that, they said. Millions of people. Ron Paul went from being the best kept secret of, you know, basically one libertarian in every neighborhood in America. Did you know there's one good congressman? No, really, I swear to God, there's one who he's really good on all this stuff. To being a global phenomenon. And why can't Rand lasso that excitement? Why can't he make people love him? It's because he refuses to be good on war and the Fed. Oh, we should audit the Fed. Audit the Fed. Abolish the Fed. And why is it important that the position is abolish the Fed? Because it obviously, necessarily raises the question, why? Why would you abolish the Fed? We all learned in school that if we have freedom, we'll have a terrible boom-bust cycle. And the Fed smooths that out. So why would you abolish the Fed? Ta-da! Austrian answer. Central banking, fractional reserve banking, especially when it's backed up by a government central bank, is what causes the boom and bust cycle. A free economy would be free of it. You see? You can't be president anyway, so go ahead and tell them the truth. Go ahead and tell them the heroic truth. central banking and war. War and central banking. How do you afford a world empire? You inflate. What's your excuse to inflate? Hey, got a world empire we got to finance here. You see how that works? This is how Ron Paul changed the world. He told the simple truth about central banking and war. Rand Paul had a meeting and said, okay, guys, I guess we're all agreed that the one thing that we'll never do is talk about central banking and war. The one thing we'll never be good on is central banking and war. And if we're good on it, sometimes we'll always make sure to be wishy-washy and half-assed and change our position back and forth. If we're going to say anything about the Fed, let's just say audit it. Let's not talk about what the problem is other than just, you know, cronyism. But let's not talk about its larger, the seeds of destruction it sows for the rest of the economy. No. Why would that be a forbidden topic? I don't understand. Except Mitch McConnell and them said, yeah, no. Or Citigroup said, hey, never going to get money from us, pal, or whatever his problem is. And then, like I said, yesterday's on Wolf Blitzer being good on Afghanistan, kind of. I mean, I missed the first part. He may have said something about the poor innocents killed, although I don't think so. But at least he was saying, yeah, we should get up and get out of Afghanistan. But does that mean that any of us can count on him to be good on any other foreign policy issue at any given time? No, of course not. He's still bad on Iran. He's bad on Israel. He's bad on Guantanamo. He wants to declare war on ISIS, which makes him actually as bad or worse than any of them. He wants to give the Kurds their own separate state and necessarily get America into a war with Iraqi Shiistan, Syria, Turkey, and Iran all at the same damn time. Hey, everybody, let's do a viral video thing where young people make videos for the campaign. Here are your topics. Term limits. And a flat VAT tax. All right, anyway. Goddamn Rand Paul. So Zbigniew Brzezinski wrote this thing for the Financial Times, and he says, you know, he refers to Russia bombing CIA-backed FSA types. And he says, if they do that anymore, America should retaliate. He's urging dogfights between America and Russia over Syria. I mean, what does he even talk? Here's what he says. The Russian naval and air presences in Syria are vulnerable. Isolated geographically from their homeland, Brzezinski noted, presumably from North America. They could be disarmed if they persist in provoking the U.S. Disarmed? He's saying we should sink Russian ships in the Mediterranean Sea? That U.S. fighters should get into dogfights with the MiGs over Syria? But then, here's the thing. If you read the thing, you're going to wonder, like me, whether he's getting just senile now. He's in his 90s. He's talking crazy. He's saying we should risk nuclear war over, you know, just another Bay of Pigs of, you know, some Al-Qaeda guys America has built up. If the Russians are bombing our Al-Qaeda guys, we ought to get into World War III to defend Al-Qaeda from Russia. Says Zbigniew Brzezinski. And then the rest of his article is about how what we ought to do is work with Russia on this whole thing. He implies in order to fight ISIS, but he doesn't really exactly say that. And then he says, and we should bring in the Chinese. And we should make sure that that the Chinese are as involved as possible in what's going on in Russia, in Syria right now. The whole thing is nonsensical. I think if you read it, you'll laugh or scratch your head and be confused. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still. If you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders, quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for Liberty.me. the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Now, I don't really know what's going to happen in with this Syria thing. I mean, Jesus. I guess I was naive. After the declaration of the caliphate, I thought, well, they're going to have to abandon their overthrow Assad policy now. Or they're at least their back the Mujahideen against him somewhat policy. And they really didn't. They started bombing the Islamic State in Iraq and in Syria a bit, but they've continued to support Jabhat al-Nusra, which is just al-Qaeda in Syria, Ahrar al-Sham, which are their best buds, and the various FSA groups that are all a bunch of head-chopping, suicide-bombing, Islamic State-creating lunatics anyway. You know, I didn't think they would be able to turn right around a lie with Assad, Iran, and Russia, and Hezbollah against them, because obviously the politics of the situation are crazy. Not that I'm recommending that. I'm just saying, you know, from the point of view of the prerogatives of the empire, I want complete and total non-intervention. In fact, the abolition of the U.S. government completely. How can it intervene when it doesn't exist? That's what I'm calling for here. I ain't shy. But point being, I thought, well, you know, this is kind of awkward. you know, this ain't the 1980s. This is post-September 11th, post-Iraq War II, where 4,500 Americans died fighting the Sunni-based insurgency and al-Qaeda in Iraq. And yet here Obama's policy has been to back the veterans of al-Qaeda in Iraq from Iraq War II in Libya and in Syria this whole time. When it culminates in the actual creation of an Islamic State, it's like, you're warned on this show was happening. You can go and read my article, Stupidity or the Plan, that I wrote for the Future of Freedom Foundation a year. I wrote it in May of 2013, a year before the declaration of the caliphate, saying, hey man, lawless Western Iraq and lawless Eastern Syria and an al-Qaeda group, again calling itself the Islamic State, used to be of Iraq, but now of Iraq and Syria, that could become a real reality here. The beginnings, I call it, of the Islamo-fascist caliphate that was just the dream, the propaganda myth of George Bush and the neocons and Osama bin Laden's wildest fantasies as he was holed up in his attic. Holed up in his attic. That was his caliphate. Two or three rooms on the third floor. And no sooner was he dead than Obama set about creating just exactly that. Now we're in a situation where the Russians have basically called our bluff and said, you know, this has gone too far. It's interesting, and it's right after they lost that highway. I forget which highway it was, but Patrick Coburn was reporting that the major artery between Aleppo and Damascus was under threat, and that was the final straw, apparently, for the Russians to come in. And so the Americans' bluff is called, right? That should mean that, okay, well, you have to at least back off now. Stop supporting Ahrar al-Sham and working with the Saudis and Turks to support al-Nusra, etc. But then again, I don't know, man. They're so stuck in their narrative in D.C. You see the way they generate all this righteous indignation that how dare the Russians back a bunch of CIA-backed terrorists. Hey, those are our terrorists that you're bombing. Stop it. You know, 2 weeks ago, they were saying, yeah, all America ever trained was just a handful of guys completely ignoring the CIA program that's been going on for years here and only referring to the DOD program. We even had to bring Adam Johnson on from Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting to document all the different media sources who were refusing to acknowledge the presence of CIA-backed forces there at all. And then as soon as the Russians start bombing them, they go, oh, they're bombing our CIA-backed moderate forces. Yeah, what's so moderate about any of these forces? Nothing. They never explain that part of it, do they? That's because they're lying. That's because they're not moderate. The Al-Farouk Brigade, that's the footage. You remember that from 2013 of the guy eating the dead soldier's heart? That was the leader of the Al-Farouk Brigade. Oh, no, they're really secular, Scott Horton. They want to hold elections. And then, I guess, eat those they defeat. Or lose to, either way, right? They're real Democrats. The Al-Farouk Brigade. And the rest of them. You know, the Northern Storm Brigade. They were the guys that met with John McCain. And they were the ones who sold Stephen Sotloff to ISIS. For money. Brad Hoff was on the show a couple of weeks ago talking about, yeah, they were also there fighting with Omar the Chechen, who is now the leader. He's really a Georgian, who's the leader of the Islamic State's military forces. Originally, as Mitchell Prothero reported, trained by the United States as a sergeant in the Georgian military. He was, I guess, had a Muslim mother and a Christian father. His mother died. He decided to move towards Islam. The Saudis have been bankrolling a bunch of Salafi mosques in his area in Georgia, in the Penkisi Gorge. And him and his buddies took off to go and fight in Syria. And Brad Hoff says, yeah, here he is, fighting with the Free Syrian Army. Fighting with the Northern Storm Brigade against Assad's forces. And he was the guy that brought in all the suicide bombers that made the difference in the big battle for, I forgot what was the name of the airbase, back in 2012 or 13. This is now the guy that's the head of the Islamic State's military. The Jordanians were saying that, yeah, it's true. Some of the guys who are in the Islamic State now were trained by the CIA in Jordan. It's been reported widely over and over again. Washington Post, New York Times, not even shy about it. No point in denying it. That legions of American-backed moderates, whether directly trained by the U.S. or just backed by them, have gone over to Al-Qaeda all along, over and over again, if not the Islamic State. Which, isn't it so funny the way they portray Al-Qaeda as the moderate force? It's a nice little rhetorical slide his hand there. ISIS, even more brutal than Al-Qaeda. And then Al-Qaeda, really moderate compared to the Islamic State. But no, that's not true. They're all bin Laden's men. They're all suicide bombing, head chopping, war criminal lunatics. The only difference is Al-Qaeda is traditionally, at least, more bent on attacking the West when they're not, you know, gratefully accepting our arms. Whereas the Islamic State guys want to go ahead and get a move on and create their Islamic State now instead of waiting for someday. It's a tactical difference. But they're all still use suicide bombers and behead their and crucify their prisoners, etc., etc. It's been like that too, man. Remember the kid who had the fruit stand in Aleppo, I think it was, and somebody asked him for a discount on an apple or whatever, and he said, oh, come on, I wouldn't even give a discount to Mohammed. Which was just his way of saying that, like, hey, man, there are no deals. The price is the price. And the Nusra guy shot him right in the face. He was a 15-year-old kid. And, oh, I don't even know if it was al-Nusra, actually. That may have been an FSA guy at the time. And he shot him right in the face. You can see all the cruise missile liberals on Twitter trying to discredit Patrick Coburn, which I agree that... He's way over the line calling for any Western government to do anything about the Islamic State at all, or to do anything. I mean, I understand his concern about the Islamic State. I don't understand how that translates into support for action other than negotiation, other than ordering our proxies to stop backing them. But they try to attack him because he tells the truth about these FSA guys. They ain't moderate at all. They're butchers of innocence, too.
Hey, y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts. Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our status enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org.
All right. So I guess we all know what my speech is going to be about on Saturday. I just love this headline. Saudi clerics urge jihad against Syria, Iran, and Russia. Statement calls for backing Islamist holy warriors in Syria. And just stop right there, Americans, and ask yourself, which side is the United States on in this conflict? Da, na, 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 na. Da, na, 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 na. Na, 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 na. That's right. Your entire government is guilty of the highest treason. All of them. All of them. The entire Republican and Democratic parties, the entire national security state, every general, every admiral, every CIA officer, they are on the side of your enemy. Al-Qaeda. Ayman al-Zawahiri's men. Your government is backing your enemies. And conservatives wonder, oh, wonder, how come the Republicans aren't attacking Obama for being guilty of treason all day when he's guilty of treason all day? The answer is because they're even worse than him on it. Because they are even more loyal to foreign governments like the government of Israel and the government of Saudi Arabia than Obama. Because they're even worse traitors to the 300 million of us who live, you know, somewhere between Mexico and Canada than the goddamn Democrats. That's why you have to go all the way to complete freaks like Pamela Geller or Frank Gaffney or these ridiculous scum to find right-wingers who are concerned about American support for jihad. Because they're wacky enough that they'll go off the script. And the script is, Israel wants America to support the jihad, so shut up. So you have to go to Pamela Geller. You have to go to outright, basically, Klansmen on the right to point out that, wow, look, the Republican rhinos and the Democrats are backing America's enemies. I mean, what does this tell you? Saudi clerics urge jihad against Syria, Iran, and Russia. That is, American clerics urge jihad against Syria, Iran, and Russia. That is, Saudi clerics urge jihad against the U.S., Syria, Iran, and Russia. That means our government is on the side of our enemies against us. That's the whole thing, man. You know, the 9/11 truthers are on to something. They might as well have done it to us, our own government. For to the degree they exploited it, the cynicism with which they exploited it, might as well have done it. Just as guilty, no less guilty. And then, look at this. I mean, that's just a blip. It's like, with this much time passed from the end of the Carter years through now the end of the Obama years, it's like there was a little bit of an aberration in the 90s when Al-Qaeda and America were attacking each other. You know, Bill Clinton still supported them in Bosnia. still supported them in Kosovo, even while they were attacking us all through the 90s. And then, yeah, there was kind of a, you know, call it a little bit of a discrepancy there when Al-Qaeda killed 3,000 Americans on September 11th. 3,000 more fighting. Well, it wasn't really mostly them, but still, I guess, probably a good 1,000 of the 3,000 deaths fighting against the Sunni-based insurgency in Iraq. That's just a slight discrepancy in the policy. When you go all the way back from Carter through Obama years, Al-Qaeda works for the USA. And what else do you need to hear? Saudi clerics urge jihad against Syria, Iran, and Russia. And whose side is America on? Saudi's side. Al-Qaeda's side. And why? Because, man, because that is what Israel wants. That's why.
If we have to choose the lesser of evils here, the lesser evil is the Sunnis over the Shiites. It's an evil, believe me, it's a terrible evil. Again, they've just taken out 1,700 former Iraqi soldiers and shot them in a field. But who are they fighting against? They're fighting against the proxy with Iran that's complicit in the murder of 160,000 people in Syria. You can just, you know, do the math. And again, one side is armed with suicide bombers and rockets. The other side has access to military nuclear capabilities. So from Israel's perspective, if there's got to be an evil that's going to prevail, you know, let the Sunni evil prevail.
There you go. That's it. And of course, both of his justifications are outright lies, right? At least half of the casualties in the Syria war are members of the Syrian military. 100,000 of them. Twice as many of the number of Americans that died in Vietnam. But he's responsible for all the deaths. Never mind the fact that the whole world knows that America, Israel, Turkey, Saudi, Qatar have been financing and even importing the other side in the war this whole time. It's a foreign invasion much more than it's any kind of civil war, especially when at least huge pluralities, if not the majority, of Syrian Sunnis still support the government, as compared to being ruled by al-Nusra or the Islamic State. And then, oh, because they have access to military nuclear technology. Oh, really? Yeah, because let's just close our eyes, squeeze them real tight, and pretend that Iran has nuclear bombs. That they ever even tried to make them. That they succeeded in making them. And now they're passing them out to Hezbollah in Syria. What a load of crap. That's really the best that Michael Oren, the Israeli ambassador to the United States, can come up with? Dan Sanchez, in his new article at antiwar.com, paraphrases him just right. Screw your towers. F you and your towers, America. Love Israel. And of course, Benjamin Netanyahu said right after the September 11th attacks that they are very good. I mean, very good for Israel, because now, of course, America will identify all their enemies with ours. He also later said, we are truly benefiting from the American struggle in Iraq, from the attack on the World Trade Center towers, and the American struggle in Iraq, he said, blatantly. This is perfect for us to exploit. Screw them and their towers full of civilians. And notice, not just we're benefiting from the regime change, the getting rid of Saddam Hussein, the bringing down of the Ba'athist system. No, from the American struggle in Iraq. The more Americans are dying in Iraq, the better for Israel, says Benjamin Netanyahu, their current prime minister. Why is that? Because it makes you angry. And it makes you identify, especially with the Israel lobby and the way that the neocons control the narrative in America, it helps you to be angry enough to confuse and conflate Israel's enemies with yours. As though the people of Iraq are the Palestinians. As though the Palestinians are the Iraqis. Or Al-Qaeda, who knocked your towers down. Read it and weep, man. It's in the Israeli press. That's not conspiracy theory stuff. It's just right there. Netanyahu, we are benefiting from the attack on the World Trade Center and the American struggle in Iraq. That's after he said it's good, very good for Israel, right after it happened. And so there you go. And I guess, you know, there must be some American interest in this, but I sure can't see it. Does trying to bribe Netanyahu to shut up, does that count as an American politician's interest? I guess I could see that from their point of view.
Our allies in the region were our largest problem in Syria. The Turks were great friends, the Saudis, the Emiratis, etc. They were so determined to take down Assad, they poured hundreds of millions of dollars and tens, thousands of tons of weapons into anyone who would fight against Assad. Except that the people who were being supplied were al-Nusra and al-Qaeda.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com.
All right, you guys. Welcome back to the thing here. Coming up, Rob Bryan is going to be on the show. There is an interview on the show today. You just got to wait more. He's from Mondo Weiss. Wrote something that I think you'll be interested to hear him talk about. Mm-hmm. Yeah. This Saturday, I'm giving a speech. It's going to be a lot like what I just said, only hopefully a bit more factual and coherent. Longer. It's in Fort Worth at Texas Christian University. It's a whole big to-do, man. It's called Make Conversation, Not War. It's put on by the Texas Millennial Institute. Tickets cost nothing. And it's me, Angela Keaton, Jacob Hornberger, Ted Carpenter from Cato, who's one of their anti-war guys, and a lady named Gada Mukdad, who I don't know too much about, but I read one article that she wrote with Kate Gould about why we ought to negotiate an end to the Syrian war instead of fighting an end to it. So I like that. Yeah, it's about a 3.5-hour drive from here, so I'm going to write my speech on the way there. I'm just going to basically drive my wife crazy talking about what I'm going to say the whole time, thinking about it. Maybe jot down a few notes. I guess I could do a better job than that, but I really got most of my footnotes I need in my brain already. Against the Terror War, that's the name of my speech. What all everyone else is talking about, I don't know. But mine's going to be against the terror war. Because I don't like it. All right, now, this is the part of the show that I should do more often, which is the you ought to help support this show part of the show. There are lots of ways to do it. I was reminded at the break because PayPal says you received a payment. One of them
is for $100.
Whoa.
Very nice. Thank you. The other one is for 1 cent. Hey, that's pretty cool. Thanks. Not thank you quite as much as the 100, but, you know, decimal point maybe is just in the wrong place accidentally, or maybe that's all you can afford, but you're trying to do what you can. I appreciate that. Hey, that's 12 cents a year. That's enough to take care of a poor kid in a Palestinian refugee camp for a month. So that's pretty good. You too could sign up. Oh, you know what? This isn't even, I guess I never really noticed this, but I should have. It's a penny a week that he's given here, not a penny a month. I didn't realize you could even sign up for weekly. You can sign up for weekly. He's doing penny a week. So that's 52 cents a year. You could sponsor 2 kids in a Palestinian refugee camp. Very nice. I do appreciate that. I'm not being sarcastic, man. Every little bit helps. So just think, if everybody who listened to the show all gave 52 cents a year, why? We'd take care of a few kids in a Palestinian refugee camp. It'd be great. Yeah. You too can sign up. Go to scotthorton.org/donate and sign up for whatever you want. Some people donate a penny. Some people donate $100. I think the truth is somewhere in the middle. You can decide. scotthorton.org/donate. Anybody who donates $50, you get a free audiobook of your choice from Listen and Think Audio. Anybody who donates $100, you get your choice of actual books, or the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism versus Capitalism, narrated by me. And anybody who donates $200 to the show gets a lifetime subscription to Listen and Think Audio, which is libertarian audiobooks. From now on, they've already done a couple of dozen audiobooks, and they're going to do dozens and dozens and scores and hundreds more. Derek Sheriff, he's a man on a mission. He just wants to put all libertarianism on audiobook for people who like audiobooks. That's it. Listen and Think Audio. You'll get a lifetime subscription to every audiobook they've ever done or ever will do for free if you donate $200 to this show. That's his way of helping to support this show. Isn't that cool of him? Isn't that cool of you, possibly? All right. And then, there's also Google Wallet and WePay and these other things. I don't know if they all work so well anymore, but there you should. If you want to help support the show, scotthorton.org/donate. And what I really need is more advertisers. And what I really need is to say that more often on the show. You too can advertise on this show. I'll cut you a real good deal. Let's see if we can make a little bit of money. So, anybody who has ever considered, hey, maybe I should advertise on the Scott Horton Show. Yes, you should. Let's do it. Just email me, scott@scotthorton.org. All right. Now, I got this crazy thing in my police state section I got to talk to you about today. Where the hell did it go? All right, I'm going to have to find it in my tweets here, man. Hang on. I got it in my tweets, and it'll be easy to find because of the picture. Check it out. Boingboing.net. Reputation economy dystopia. China's new citizen scores will rate every person in the country. And I know what you're thinking. Yeah, would, like a credit score, right? Yeah, sorta. Boingboing.net. The Chinese government has announced a new universal reputation score tied to every person in the country's national ID number and based on such factors as political compliance, hobbies, shopping, and whether or not one plays video games. It is a perfect storm of terrible. The program will be administered by Alibaba, China's answer to Amazon, and Tencent, the country's huge government-compliant social network, their Facebook. Your score will be generated not only by your activities,
but by the activities of the friends in your social graph, the people you identify as friends on social media. Your score will be decremented for doing things like mentioning Tiananmen Square, or speculating on official corruption, or for participating in activities that the state wishes to, quote, nudge you away from, like playing video games. My God, is this not every Republican and Democrat's dream of how to create a totalitarian state for the rest of us? And put a shock collar on each and every one of you. You better keep your score up, buddy. All scores are public to everyone, and high-scoring individuals will get privileges denied to their less fortunate peers, such as permits to visit or live in Singapore. Already, some Chinese people are embracing their scores as bragworthy. And then, so here, oh, I like this. He says, it's like someone took all my novels, whoever this guy is, and blended them together and turned them into a policy with Chinese characteristics. Everybody is measured by a score between 350 and 950, which is linked to their national ID card. While currently supposedly voluntary, the government has announced it will be mandatory by 2020. System is run by the two companies. In addition to measuring your ability to pay as in the U.S., the score serves as a measure of political compliance. Among the things that will hurt a citizen's score are posting political opinions without prior permission or posting information the regime does not like. It will hurt your score not only if you do these things, but if any of your friends do them. Imagine the social pressure against disobedience or dissent that this will create. Hey, if you're not doing anything wrong, you don't have anything to worry about. Why not just plug us into the giant matrix battery machines now and get it over with?
Hey, Al Scott here. If you've got a band, a business, a cause, or campaign, and you need stickers to help promote, check out thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. They digitally print with solvent ink, so you get the photo quality results of digital with the strength and durability of old-style screen printing. I'm sure glad I sold thebumpersticker.com to Rick back when. He's made a hell of a great company out of it, and there are thousands of satisfied customers who agree with me, too. Let thebumpersticker.com help you get the word out. That's thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
All right, guys, so Nick Terse has a thing at The Intercept today about why bombing the Kunduz hospital was probably a war crime. You know, never mind about morality, but just technically, was it or not? And the answer is, hell yes. But I would just direct your attention to the picture at the top. You're telling me the U.S. didn't know that that was a hospital? You know, I really don't like it when people lie to me. Also, burning little children to death in their beds, take offense. But then you try to tell me that oops. Go to TheIntercept.com and look at this piece by Nick Terse and look at this picture. There's a tweet like this at my Twitter feed today from earlier this morning, too. If you page down, you'll see it. It's this huge campus with a gigantic hospital in the middle, a long building in the middle with, you know, it's not quite a cross because the crossbar isn't symmetrical or whatever. But it's a huge building, and it's surrounded by a giant piece of property with very few other buildings. I mean, in other words, this is just the most distinctive thing in the entire damned city. There is no way a C-130 was flying over this thing and didn't know what they were shooting. I mean, this is just completely out of control here. And by the way, from the The Guardian this morning, Spencer Ackerman has this piece. Doctors Without Borders airstrike. U.S. alters story for fourth time in 4 days. Doctors Without Borders is saying this is an admission of a war crime on their part. U.S. Special Operations Forces, not their Afghan allies, called in the deadly airstrikes on the Doctors Without Borders hospital in Kunduz. The U.S. commander has conceded. See, that was what I told you on the show yesterday, that Jim Mikulski at NBC was quoting the general. And that was their fourth version. Shortly before General John Campbell, the commander of the U.S. and NATO war in Afghanistan, Shortly before General John Campbell, commander of the U.S. and NATO war in Afghanistan, testified to a Senate panel, the president of Doctors Without Borders, also known as Medicine Sans Frontiers, said the U.S. and Afghanistan had made, quote, an admission of a war crime, shifting the U.S. account of the Saturday morning airstrike for the fourth time in as many days. Campbell reiterated that Afghan forces had requested U.S. air cover after being engaged in a tenacious fight to retake the northern city of Kunduz from the Taliban. But modifying the account he gave at a press conference on Monday, Campbell said those Afghan forces had not directly communicated with the U.S. pilots of an AC-130 gunship overhead. Even though the Afghans quote the general, request that support, it still has to go through a rigorous U.S. procedure to enable fires to go on the ground. To enable fires to go on the ground? We had a special operations unit. He means kill the people. Shoot them to death. We had a special operations unit that was in close vicinity that was talking to the aircraft that delivered those fires. You gotta love government employees, man. You know, George Carlin, I played that clip for you about all the euphemisms and whatever. I think he probably wouldn't even have a joke to crack about this, right? He would just shake his head and just be sad. The aircraft that delivered those fires. Shut up. God. The airstrike on the hospital is among the worst and most visible cases of civilian deaths caused by U.S. forces during the 14-year Afghan war that Barack Obama has declared all but over. It killed 12 Medicine Sans Frontiers staff and 10 patients who had sought medical treatment after the Taliban overran Kunduz last weekend. 3 children died in the airstrike that came in multiple waves and burned patients alive in their beds. On Tuesday, Medicine Sans Frontiers denounced Campbell's press conference as an attempt to shift the blame to the Afghans. The U.S. military remains responsible for the targets it hits, even though it's part of a coalition, said its Director General Christopher Stokes. Isn't it funny? This kind of goes without saying. We all just skip right past it and don't even mention it. There's no question that it was NATO that did it because it was an air attack. And after 14 years of victory in Afghanistan, they don't have anything like an air force of their own. They have nothing. And the Americans wouldn't trust them with one anyway. You know, an air force would just be one insider attack away from a big kamikaze into Kabul. They wouldn't dare. 14 years. The Doctors Without Borders guy said, the U.S. military remains responsible for the targets it hits, even though it's part of a coalition. You would think that that would go without saying. The fact they're trying to blame the Afghans is just pathetic. I mean, whatever, if it'll work on you for a moment, that's all they need it to do. Campbell did not explain whether the procedures to launch the airstrike took into account the GPS coordinates of the field hospital, which its president, Joanne Liu, said were regularly shared with U.S. coalition and Afghan military officers and civilian officials as recently as Tuesday, the 29th of September. AC-130 gunships, which fly low, typically rely on a pilot visually identifying a target. It's also unclear where the U.S. Special Operations Forces were relative to the fighting, but Campbell said that U.S. units were not directly engaged in the fighting. Anyway, I gotta stop here. Oh man, I'm already almost out of time for this segment, but I gotta tell you about some of this. I don't think this interview is gonna be broad enough to cover this stuff, so I guess I'll just ask you to rush over to MondoWeiss.net. That's Philip Weiss's site. He's got a bunch of great writers there. Clashes break out all across West Bank after Netanyahu declares, quote, an all-out war. Is one of the headlines there from today, not from yesterday. Jerusalem at a breaking point. Video of 18-year-old Palestinian chased by Jewish mob and killed by police shocks global audience. I know, if you're an American, you've seen a million of these, but still, it's, you know, they just shoot the guy dead for no good reason. He doesn't reach for his waistband or anything. Palestinian sources, 13-year-old killed in clash. I think they buried him now. This one was a few days old. The IDF shot and killed a 13-year-old. Two more Palestinian teenagers killed. Palestinian Red Crescent Society, that's their Red Cross equivalent thing, declared state of emergency in the West Bank. And we'll be right back in just a sec with this interview with Rob Bryan. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new ebook by longtime Future Freedom author Scott McPherson. Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms. This is the definitive principled case in favor of gun rights and against gun control. America is exceptional. Here the people come first, and we refuse to allow the state a monopoly on firearms. Our liberty depends on it. Get Scott McPherson's Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms on Kindle at Amazon.com today. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for MPV Engineering. This isn't for all of you, but for high-end contractors specializing in industrial construction and end users who own and operate industrial equipment, MPV offers licensed professional consulting on chemical and mechanical engineering for your projects. Tanks, pressure vessels, piping, heat exchangers, HVAC equipment, chemical reactors for oil companies or manufacturing facilities, as well as project management support and troubleshooting for those implementing designs. MPV will get your industrial project up and running. Head over to MPVEngineering.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Sign up for the podcast feed at scotthorton.org for the archives live here, noon to two at the Liberty Radio Network, on the Liberty Radio Network, and at it. All right, our guest today is Rob Bryan. He's a freelance journalist from New York. And he wrote this piece for MondoWeiss.net. It's called The Refreshing Bluntness of Ailet Shaked. Welcome to the show. Rob, how are you doing?
I'm good. How are you? Thanks for having me.
I'm doing real good. Appreciate you joining us today. Who is Ailet Shaked, and what is so refreshing about her bluntness?
Well, she is a far right-wing politician in Israel. She was recently appointed the justice minister. She's part of a party called Jewish Home, which is led by a guy named Naftali Bennett. And, you know, I make the comparison in the article. It's sort of useful to think of her almost as Israel's version of Trump. And incidentally, I think Trump is actually pretty popular over there, but you know, she talks a lot about what she calls the infiltrators or immigrants, asylum seekers, people coming from Sudan and Eritrea, seeking asylum in Israel. And she's very determined to keep them out and also to, you know, deprive Palestinians of basic civil rights. And she sort of became notorious, actually, before she became justice minister, for sharing a Facebook post, that was written by this, kind of extremist settler, and he referred to Palestinians as snakes, and said that basically we should wipe them out and we should kill their mothers and destroy their houses so that they can't raise any more snakes. So she became sort of infamous for basically using this, you know, genocidal rhetoric against Palestinians.
Yeah, now, that is an amazing quote, although I don't know how many points you take off for it being sort of a retweet rather than her own words, which when I first had heard that, I thought, wow, those were her words. It was the way it was originally reported, or at least the way I took
it.
Yeah,
it was unpublished, so that was kind of the first published example of those words, even though they weren't technically hers.
Oh, I see. So the first published version. Well, and you know what? However many points you take off for it being not exactly her own words, but just the first time that anyone put that out in public or whatever, still, that's a lot of points already, the bad way, for what the quote actually says here. I mean, when you say snakes, that's a specific reference to the children, right? To their babies.
And, you know, a lot of sort of genocidal, you know, rulers over the years have used that kind of rhetoric in terms of the people they're trying to wipe out. They refer to them as vermin or snakes. It's a way to sort of make them seem subhuman.
And of course, the mothers of the martyrs, they don't get to be individuals themselves. You know, they only exist in order to create more martyrs. They're just, you know, and martyrs, of course, is a sarcastic term for, you know, Palestinian resistance, people who must be killed by, the Israeli side. They don't have any of their own agency. They're just here to create more enemies for us. So their lives are forfeit too.
Right. Basically.
Incredible. And then here's the other thing I like about this, and I'm sorry, we're going to move on to the rest of your article and everything here, but before we leave this quote, I think it's just worth pointing out here, if people look at it, especially at the beginning, the way that she uses the term peoples, the whole peoples are the enemy, the whole people, this and that, these kind of collectivist terms, they're actually ridiculous when you read about them in a contemporary context. Like if you were talking about some extinct faction of American Indians that don't exist anymore, and you were to say, oh, they were a people who lived in the Phoenix Valley before they were all exterminated or something like that, you could say a people in that kind of context, maybe, but even then it's clumsy phrasing, right? A people, you know, but the way she uses it in order to collectivize and dehumanize all Palestinians is just so ham-handed and blatant. I like it, you know, basically. The lesson is so clear there. Individuals have human rights. Collectives can be characterized as demon enemies that must be destroyed with ease. And that's exactly what she's up to, but in the most kind of overly simplistic way. Like when you watch a TV commercial from the 1950s or something, and it just seems so corny and lame, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Horrible. All right. Sorry. Now, so then you went and saw her give a talk in Israel. I mean, in New York. Is that right?
Right. Yeah, at the Yeshiva University Museum.
And how'd it go?
It was kind of weird. I mean, it was very small. It was maybe 30 people or so, and they were just kind of sitting in chairs in this big atrium of this museum. And she was talking with a Cardozo professor. Cardozo is the law school associated with Yeshiva University. And that's more of a secular law school. So Yeshiva University undergrad is more, you know, the religious Jewish institution. And then the law school tends to be more secular. But anyway, so it was this woman, Professor Stone, Suzanne Stone, who was talking to Ayla Shaked, and it was almost like, you know, I compared it to something you'd see in a bookstore. It was this very sort of like casual discussion, but it was all about this thing called Shemitah, which is a part of the Jewish tradition. Yeah, I was raised kind of more like secular Jewish, so I didn't know that much about it, but I was reading about it. It's basically the Jewish sabbatical year that also functions as a kind of like jubilee, so it's debt forgiveness. And she basically supported, which I actually think, you know, in another context would be a good thing, debt forgiveness for all these people who, it turns out, were totally incapable of paying back their debt. So she gave debt relief to 30,000 people, and that was a big focus of the talk. She didn't really address the, you know, the snakes remark, but she did talk a lot about African immigrants who arrive here on foot. And one of the craziest parts of the talk to me, and I mentioned it in the article, is when she said, you know, Israel's not like the U.S. It's not a nation of immigrants. And I just thought, you know, that was just like the craziest thing I'd ever heard, right?
How many people busted out laughing when she said that?
Nobody. That's the other thing. I mean, I think everyone there was pretty much sort of came to the honor side, besides the guy at the end who I mentioned. But it seemed to be a pretty conservative crowd. And I think, first of all, Israel obviously was started in pretty much entirely by Jewish refugees, and also the founding of Israel in 1948, what Palestinians referred to as the Nakba, itself created about 700,000 Palestinian refugees who are now arguing for right of return. So on a lot of levels, including a religious level, which I mentioned as well, you know, the story of Moses fleeing slavery in Egypt, and journeying across the Sinai Desert to the Promised Land, that's also, of course, the story, the religious story of Israel. So on many different levels, Israel is a country of refugees, of immigrants, and for her to just dismiss that or, you know, deny it entirely was kind of incredible.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you this. If you accepted her premises of the demographic threat to the Jewish supermajority there, does she even have a point? How many refugees are we even talking about here?
She claims that it would be millions and that you would have Syrian refugees, and it could be a lot of refugees. But the question is, do you need to basically, as she acknowledges, and this is, again, why I say it's refreshing that she's so blunt about it, unlike more, liberal kind of liberal Zionist Israeli politicians, they try to sort of hide it a little bit. But basically, the idea is that if you don't have, a Jewish majority, then in a democracy, it ceases to be a Jewish state. So you need at least over 50% Jewish, basically. And ideally, to Zionists, you have, a comfortable majority, 60, 70 or more. I think Israel is about 80% Jewish now. So, that's what she said during the talk, actually. I'm not entirely sure about that. But, so, in any case, if you see that demographic threat as threatening the Jewish state and wanting it to be destroyed, I think that's sort of a mischaracterization. It doesn't necessarily mean, at least from my point of view, I don't wish harm on anyone in that region. But I think they should be able to live together ideally in a secular democratic state that doesn't discriminate on the basis of religion. So I tend to be more of, a one-state solution person. There is an argument to be made for two states, but to me, the real crux of the issue is that you need equal rights for everyone, and obviously that's not the case.
Yeah, and that the Israeli solution is no solution, just facts on the ground and perpetual war and
right,
terror,
it's sort of slowly occupying or slowly settling, the West Bank and kind of just annexing more and more land.
Yeah. All right, now hold it right there because I actually kept you into the break here, but let's finish up the break and then let the live audience hear the rest of this discussion too.
All right, sounds good.
Okay, right back in a sec. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Roberts & Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. Hey, y'all, Scott here for Samurai Tech Academy at MasterSamuraiTech.com. Modern appliance repair requires true technicians who can troubleshoot their high-tech electronics. If you're young and looking to make some real money, or you've been at it a while and just need to keep your skills up to date, Samurai Tech Academy teaches it all. And they'll also show you the business, how to own and run your own. Take a free sample course to see how easily you can learn appliance repair from MasterSamuraiTech.com. Use coupon code Scott Horton for 10% off any course or set of courses at MasterSamuraiTech.com. All right, you guys, Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. I know I'm really bad about sticking to these hard breaks. Need soft breaks is what I need, but what a hassle that would be. Anyway, talking with Rob Bryan. He's written this piece at MondoWeiss.net, which, you know what, there's about 10 or 15 things at MondoWeiss.net that you need to see this week, okay? So just head on over there for me, okay? All right, thank you. Sorry, I don't mean to sound patronizing. Do it for your own good if you feel like it. This is one of them. The refreshing bluntness of Ailit Shackett. And she is basically the justice minister. That means she is the attorney general of Israel, basically, for intents and purposes. It's a parliamentary system over there, but that's her, you know, she's in that post. And boy, is she refreshingly blunt, as Rob is explaining. She's not shy at all about basically explaining what amounts to, if it was in America, what we would call a white supremacist point of view. Rob?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's sad, honestly, that this has become the case. In a certain way, it does sort of follow just from the logic of Zionism itself, because if you say that, you know, a state's religious character is more important than its democratic character, then that's the result you have. You know, if the same thing is true in a place like Saudi Arabia. If, you know, it's a Muslim first, then, well, in that case, not really democratic at all. But, you know, to me, I think democracy has to come first. And in Israel, that's really just blatantly not the case. I mean, even just looking at a place like the West Bank, where so many people are living under occupation, subject to the laws of Israel, and yet don't have the right to vote, where people are, you know, incarcerated or convicted at a rate of over 99%, that's obviously not democracy. So I think what you're seeing in Israel now, unfortunately, is this kind of gradual erosion of democracy. And you see it in Netanyahu's Likud party, but you see it maybe even more clearly in the parties that are even further to the right. And, you know, remember, Netanyahu was considered by many to be the most right-wing prime minister ever. But Naftali Bennett's party, Jewish Home, which Ailit Shaked is a part of, and also Israel is Our Home, which has an almost identical name, but that's Avigdor Lieberman's party. That's another far-right-wing party. And, yeah, you hear a lot of the rhetoric that you would hear from Donald Trump, from white supremacists or, you know, quote-unquote white nationalists, who are always warning of this this threat of the other, the outsider, the immigrant, the infiltrator, as Shaked says. So, yeah, I think, you know, it's definitely scary, scary speech.
Well, and it's funny here. You got to admit, as you write it, you know, with hyphens, even using the phrase, quote, the other, to describe those as she's, we gotta, you know.
I was like, did I hear that correctly? Are you honestly using?
Yeah, it's like, I mean, she has the demagogue script, but she was supposed to, that's in parentheses and, you know, like stage directions. She's supposed to fill in her own specific, you know, term there and forgot to.
Right, yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah, this is someone who hasn't read much Edward Said, I don't think.
Probably not.
I mean, I'm too familiar with that use of the term.
Yeah, I mean, that's really something else. And of course, I mean, I don't know, this usually goes without saying, I'm not sure why, either because it's too obvious or because you're not supposed to say it or whatever, but this is especially ironic because we're talking about Jews. And they're the ones that everybody's always calling the other. And so,
yeah,
at least they got to notice the irony here or something, right? But no, it's like they just keep going. Like they're living in this fantasy world.
Well, I don't know if you know, there's the cartoonist Art Spiegelman, who had a great quote about it. He's the guy who wrote Mouse, which is this graphic novel based on his dad's experience in the Holocaust. And he described Israel as having, it's like kids that get PTSD from, you know, being abused by their parents, and then they do the same thing to their kids. So, you know, in a way, there's, it is hypocritical and ironic and all that, but it makes a weird kind of sense. It's like, you know, when they feel, I think the mentality is really one of paranoia. It's everyone's out to get us. You know, Iran is trying to kill us. Hamas is trying to kill us. Hezbollah, everyone's trying to kill us. The Palestinians at large, as she said, you know, everyone's coming to get us. And so the only way to defend ourselves and to protect ourselves is to strike first, to respond, you know, tenfold to every aggression against us, and to maintain this occupation, which is, yeah, it's really unfortunate. And hopefully there'll be more pressure on them in the future to change their ways.
Yeah, I guess, well, have you ever been over there?
Yeah, I actually, kind of embarrassing, but I went on Birthright, which is basically the, you know, Israel propaganda tour for American Jews. So I saw Israel, but it was obviously a very sort of one-sided view of it.
Well, I mean, that's kind of the side that I'm interested in. I mean, the way that you characterize it there sounded like from experience. And all I've ever seen is that documentary Defamation, where they really make Israel sound like it's America 2002 permanently, you know, where virtually every day we're just one day away from the next Holocaust, and you're all going to die, and there's enemies everywhere, and... Boy, if you actually have paranoid schizophrenia, you might as well jump off a cliff, because the fear never stops coming.
Yeah, and another thing is, you know,
it really is like that,
Iran,
though. You're saying you're basically agreeing with the thesis of that film. Then it really is like that.
Yeah,
it seems
and there
like
are a... certain things that were really odd to me. For one, the idea that Iran just wants to kill all the Jews. There are people that really face that, you know, and you know, if Iran wanted to kill every Jew in the world, they would start with the Jews living in Iran, which, you know, there are plenty of Jews living in Iran today and who are not being, you know, massacred or anything like that. And the second thing is, you know, you would hear this from Israelis, people saying, you know, the only safe place for Jews is Israel. By the way, everyone's trying to kill us all the time. And I kind of wanted to say, you know, I grew up in New York, Jewish, and you know, I always felt pretty safe. Like most of the American Jews I know in this country, obviously anti-Semitism exists here too, but you know, I think we all felt relatively safe, certainly safer than Israelis seem to feel. But there was this sort of like weird cognitive dissonance, like everyone's trying to kill us all the time, but also this is the only safe place for us, which never really added up to me.
Yeah. Well, and that does sound very American to me, too, the part about everybody trying to kill us. And let's just start with that. And let's never ask why, you know, let's never get around to whoever did what to anyone. It's always, you know, the poor little us and the other coming to get us.
Sure.
Yep. Well, and so, yeah, now it's important, as you mentioned there, that Netanyahu, he's relying on Shaked and Naftali Bennett and all these people to his right. That's who he made his coalition with, is everybody to the right of him in order to create this government. So that represents a real shift from the way it was before, where they usually always had to ally with labor somehow, right? And not like labor's really any better, but at least in spirit, they're a little bit, you know, I don't know.
Yeah. No, I think from what I've heard, it's pretty much the most right-wing coalition government in Israel's history.
And now, do you know much about what's going on with the breaking out of the new conflict in East Jerusalem and the Al-Aqsa Mosque and what some are saying is the beginning of the Third Intifada over there right now?
No, I'm not that up on it, honestly. That's a bit of a blind spot for me, but I know that Shaked was talking a little bit about the controversy over the Temple Mount and Jews not being allowed on the Temple Mount, which he said was absurd. But remind me the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
The remind you the what?
The what you were referring to?
Just the escalation of the conflict there. I mean, over at Mondo Weiss, they've been doing a great job, and there are a lot of writers at Mondo Weiss, but. There's been quite a bit of coverage of, you know, people being killed and on both sides and clashes breaking out. And some are calling it a third intifada. And I just was
trying
to take your temperature on the issue, basically, and see what you thought of it, I guess.
I mean, this is a place that's been fought over for a long time, obviously. I don't think that, I don't think that there's any real easy solution. I think, in the end, Israel kind of calls the shots. So, you know, I was reading, like, Abbas said recently that he didn't want any escalation or whatever. But the truth is, Abbas and the Palestinian Authority, they don't have that much clout, really, when it comes to these issues. So the question is, like, how much leverage do the Palestinian people have in a situation like this? And the answer is really none. I mean, they don't have a state to back them up. Abbas, who's supposed to represent them, is more of a figurehead than anything.
Yeah.
And so, I don't really know how that is going to get resolved, but in the end, Israel is going to basically do what it wants.
Yeah, you know, I'm interested in finding out which of the different political parties, the different right-wing ones, are actually interested in escalating and changing this issue. I saw where Netanyahu said, no, the status quo for the authority and what all happens at the mosque there is going to remain, which is, I think, the biggest indication that something terrible is about to happen, probably. But then, mm-hmm. You know, I guess the right-wing parties, like some of them are just Russian right-wing nationalists who aren't really religious, who are very secular, right? And then there are others who are...
Right, that's like the Avigdor Lieberman crowd.
Yeah, sure. And then I'm sure there are, I guess I don't know this, but I assume that there are factions of the religious right wingers who would be very against changing the status of the mosque for religious reasons, that we're, you know, supposedly between, Temple 2 and Temple 3 here, and you're not supposed to build the third one yet, and this and that. And so they would want to leave the status quo for whatever religious reasons. So I don't know, and I wonder if anybody knows, anyone in America can explain just who among the Israeli right are that interested in changing the status quo there, because it does seem like there's a pretty radical faction. I just wonder how much support they have for trying to basically, I think ultimately what they want to do, right, is to tear down the mosque and build the third temple there.
Right. And this is, again, like, it's a little bit of a blind spot for me, but I know there's also been some, I think, disagreement among Jews, among more Orthodox, Orthodox Jews and more secular Jews. And because when I saw Ayelet Shaked, she talked about how there's this quote-unquote discrimination against Jews on the Temple Mount, and it's absurd that we're not allowed to pray there. But she also said she didn't want any, you know, dramatic policy changes. So, you know, I think at the end of the day, they would rather sort of just, like, de-escalate it and not have it turned into a full-fledged thing. But again, that's really in the hands of Israel. They're the ones who are, I think, calling the shots in this situation.
Yeah. All right. Well, I've already kept you over time, so I'll let you go. But thanks very much for the great interview, Rob. I appreciate it.
Oh, absolutely. Thanks for having me, and I'd love to come back anytime.
All right. Good deal. Well, keep writing interesting stuff, and I will have you back then.
Absolutely.
Appreciate
thanks.
It. All right, so that is Rob Bryan. He's a freelance journalist from New York, and here he is at MondoWeiss.net, the refreshing bluntness of Ayelet Shaked.